Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly recap of Utah news by the Salt Lake Tribune. This week on the program, a series of text messages reveals heated exchanges between former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff and his former top deputy. How do these conversations fit into ongoing ethics investigations of Shurtleff and his successor, John Swallow? A recent poll of Utah voters shows 91% believe the nation's immigration system is broken and needs fixing fast. Is Congress getting the message? And nearly 20,000 people vote on whether to keep daylight saving time. What will lawmakers do with the results? All that in Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we've got immigration, we've got testy texting, we've got daylight saving time, discord in Jordan District, and much more. And joining me this morning is Tribune Assistant Managing Editor Dave Noyce. Dave, welcome back.
Hi, Jennifer.
And we expect a few other Tribune reporters to stroll in at some point. But you can join us, too, if there's a news story on your mind. You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments on our website, sltrib.com. You can also call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Dave, immigration all over the headlines this week, and our colleague Lee Davidson reported that a recent poll shows that Utahns overwhelmingly support immigration reform this year. Give us a rundown. What are the numbers?
Well, a very red state, Utah. This poll shows them very much in favor of immigration reform. 8 of every 10 Utahns want to see it enacted, and they want to see it enacted this year, just looking increasingly unlikely out of Washington. 3 of 4 support some pathway to legal status, not necessarily citizenship, but the legal status for immigrants who are here, mm-hmm. which has been a real sticking point, of course, between, say, the Senate-passed bill and sort of the logjam that's emerged in the House. Mm-hmm. So it shows pretty strong numbers that people support this. Interestingly also, I started with red state because the poll also showed that more than 70%, I believe, said that blaming the Obama administration for the immigration mess, I guess, is wrong. It's not that simple.
Plenty of blame to go around,
right,
I suppose.
Right.
And Utah business leaders gathered this week, sort of underscoring the urgency. How are they sort of framing the conversation?
I think they see it as economic development, possibly. It's hurting businesses. I think in Lee's story, the Farm Bureau farmer. They need workers, and they know a lot of these migrant laborers provide that labor that they need, and it's hurting business. I think it's addressing a reality that they see in the marketplace. That's why they've been pushing for this for a number of years.
And there was some tech sector people, too, who said, look, we need workers in Utah County.
Yeah, they want workers, and they want highly skilled workers. A lot of these people come to school here, and they get their educations, and instead of staying here and performing some of that valuable labor that we need, they go back home and take those skills with them, and they'd love to see those workers be able to stay here and help them with their forces. Yeah.
Talking immigration with Assistant Managing Editor Dave Noyce, also joining us now in the studio, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
And Robert Gerke, government reporter. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
And we're talking immigration, guys. The poll that came out here locally comes amid the crisis on the border. Tens of thousands of children flooding into the U.S., stirring up a lot of emotion. The president asking for almost $4 billion to help deal with the situation. Paul Raleigh, is this the right time for local immigration advocates to be pushing Congress?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's at a crisis situation, and you know, obviously the public prefers immigration reform. You know, I've written about this many times. This, to me, is another example of the disconnect between you know, the public and some of their elected officials because of the system of the way we elect people and because of gerrymandering. And you've got the general public on one hand that has very definite attitudes. And like Dave alluded to earlier, I mean, conservative groups very much want immigration reform. The Chamber of Commerce, the Sutherland Institute, which is one of the most conservative groups around, has long advocated for that. And it's, like Dave said, because of business interests and the need for labor. But, you know, you've got this logjam in the House, and the House, in my opinion, is a result of very extreme gerrymandering over the last few years. Those people cater to a certain extreme part of the population, which doesn't represent the majority.
So what are Utah's congressional representatives? What are they saying? What are our senators saying about this border issue and about immigration reform? I mean, it seems to me that there's some, you know, throwing up your hands. It's just not going to happen. So don't get your hopes up. Paul?
Well, you've got, you know, your certain members in the House particularly that, you know, they use every opportunity they can to blame the Obama administration, and that's what they do rather than coming up with real solutions. I don't see anything, you know, that our local representatives, you know, they've said, made some statements and platitudes and that sort of thing, but I don't see people like Jason Chaffetz really or Chris Stewart really stepping up to the plate because they're catering to that Tea Party kind of right-wing constituency that is more interested in focusing on the evils of the Obama administration than getting anything done. I see more you know, better movement in the Senate. I believe Senator Hatch is moving, you know, toward trying to come up with some kind of reform, but you've still got the local representatives in the House, the Utah representatives, that are stuck in that quagmire of catering to the extreme base.
Well, we do have congressional elections this fall. Dave Noyce, will immigration be a litmus test?
In this state?
Yes.
I'm not so sure in this state.
Is it going to come up?
I think it will come up. I mean, I think it's already coming up. I think the poll gives ammunition, at least, for people to use that, and candidates and challengers in this case, probably. Whether that will have an impact on an election here, I'm not so sure.
If yeah. I can jump in,
please.
You know, it doesn't – that's the problem. The Republicans are all going to win, and it doesn't matter what position they take. It doesn't matter, you know, how emotional the immigration debate is. The way the reality in Utah is in the three, even the Mia Love race, in the three congressional races, they're going to win. And so they can, you know, they can do anything they want, or and they'll probably do platitudes towards the other, we need to make some kind of immigration reform an issue and all that stuff. But they don't really have to worry that much. They're all going to win the race. That's it. That's a foregone conclusion. And so I don't think even the fact that the public wants immigration reform, no matter what they do, it's going to make a difference.
Robert, did you have something to add?
Oh, I was going to mention that typically with the Republicans in general, the border security is the issue that they focus on more than anything dealing with, you know, path to legalization or path normalization and things like that. And you especially have somebody like Rob Bishop, who has repeatedly for a number of years focused on the porous nature on the border, the lack of enforcement on, along the public lands in the border, and so that's where the focus on immigration, especially in the congressional elections, tends to be. Is we're going to enforce the border, and that plays, as Paul says, to the conservative base that is has a large amount of control in choosing who gets elected.
Mm. Well, we're talking local politics and the week's news here on Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's talk about another really interesting story that came out this week in the Trib. Texting, a text correspondence surfaced this week between former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff and his former deputy, Kirk Torgerson. It's full of sarcasm and defensiveness. But Robert, you reported on this. Before we get to the content, can you describe the time frame when these exchanges occurred? I guess there were several different exchanges you looked
at. They were in chunks over much of 2013, from April to November of 2013. They had various exchanges. Some of them were short, some of them were much longer, you know, but they mostly dealt with sort of the snowballing Swallow scandal, and Kirk Torgerson, who was the chief deputy under both Shurtleff and Swallow, was pretty direct in his criticism of the former attorney general, and took him to the woodshed a number of times on decisions that he had made that had cast a cloud over the office and besmirched the reputation of the office and so forth. The text, it's interesting because, you know, I think we all recognize that when you're dealing with email, you know, there are things we say face to face, there are things we say in email that we might not say face-to-face, and there are things we say in text messages, particularly when we don't think people are going to see them, that go beyond that. And so it was a very lively and frank discussion between the two men. And, mm-hmm. One of the things that jumped out at me, and I think Dave and I talked about this too, is, you know, Torgerson said that he, you know, wishes that Swallow had never been brought into the office. He couldn't believe that Shurtleff brought Swallow in to make him his sort of handpicked successor, and then Mark in the next exchange acknowledged that that was probably a mistake, but he did it in order to make sure that the people that Mark had installed in the office kept their jobs, kept their bonuses, kept their sort of fairly cushy setups with their high salaries. So mm-hmm. it was a vivid exchange, and it delved into, in some ways, some of the direct allegations that are sort of at the core of this. You know, Kirk Torgerson, who had for more than a year and a half, almost 2 years at that point, raised concerns about Mark Shurtleff's interactions with a certain cast of characters, including Tim Lawson, who was a close friend of his, who was using his influence with Shurtleff, peddling his influence with Shurtleff. And Jeremy Johnson, one of Shurtleff's biggest donors, gave $200,000 to Shurtleff's campaigns. Torgerson had said, you know, he had warned him for years to stay away from these two guys, and ultimately it was these two guys who played central roles in blowing things up in the office. The other one was the exchange about Mark Jensen, where Torgerson said he was astounded that Shurtleff would go down to California and stay in the posh Newport Beach home of a guy that the office had prosecuted and who was still technically under the office's supervision at the time that Shurtleff was down there.
Mm-hmm. So of the excerpts that we published in the Salt Lake Tribune in the April exchange, mm-hmm. Shurtleff seems very apologetic. Mm-hmm. By June, Torgerson gets really heated, and Shurtleff becomes more adamant about his innocence. And then in November, on the day that John Swallow steps down, it's brief. It's pointed, and you can tell that the feelings are pretty raw. Dave Noyce, what strikes you about the exchange? Any revelations about the characters involved in the ethics scandal surrounding the Utah Attorney General's office?
I think Robert alluded to this. It's just interesting to see. I mean, we all text. We know how we text, and we know what autocorrect sometimes does to our text. and it's interesting to see sort of the raw emotions that I think come out. I mean, Robert's uncovered most of this and covered most of this, and I don't think there were any revelations necessarily about the scandal itself. It was more the reactions to the scandal. One of the interesting things about this whole scandal is the evidence that's emerged and that we've been able to publish and obtain. We've have recordings at a Krispy Kreme donut shop. We have recordings of Jeremy Johnson in a closed room talking with prosecutors about a plea deal. Now we have email exchanges. Now we have these sort of unedited, unvarnished text messages, and I think that's what's interesting to see. I sometimes think when we get in these scams, we forget these are real people, you know, that are involved in this, and some of that realness, mm-hmm. I think, comes out in those texts.
Well, Robert, give us the backstory on how you got your hands on this this exchange, because that's pretty interesting in itself.
Well, it's something that we knew existed back in March of this year, or even earlier. I think we found out about it in early March or February. We filed a grandma request, an open records request with the Attorney General's office, and asked for them thinking it wasn't going to really be a big deal. The prosecutors in the case asked the Attorney General's office not to release the information to the media, and they complied with that. So we didn't get them from them. So it was a couple months later, there was this internal investigation into the handling of the Mark Jensen case. Mark Jensen is now doing time up in Davis County Jail on some securities charges. There have been allegations that the individuals in the Attorney General's office abused their authority. And so so Sean Reyes, when he came into office, had Paul Cassell and Francis Wickstrom do an internal review of how that case was handled. And as part of that review, there was this huge, I mean, almost 900 pages of documentation, supporting documentation and appendices. So we asked the Attorney General's office through a records request for that information. And again, they told us no. So we had to go through other channels, I guess, and we'll just leave it at that. We were able to get a copy of the appendix and buried. I mean, you know, it's three pages in this 900-page thing, but buried in the appendix are these text messages. You mentioned sort of the combative and apologetic nature, and that was sort of the character of all of them. What we published were excerpts of it, but you know, it would start out they'd be at each other's throat, and then they'd kind of, you know, oh, I love you, man, and, you know, kind of mend fences and leave it at that. And then they'd be at each other's throat again. And at the end of it, you know, I thought that last one, the last exchange you referenced, where it was the day that Swallow resigned and Kirk Torgerson texted Mark Shurtleff and said something to the effect of, what a nice outcome of all of this. And Shurtleff says, what do you mean by that? And Torgerson, you know, notes that he was being sarcastic. You know, Shurtleff says, this has been awful. And Torgerson says, exactly. And Shurtleff actually apologizes to him and says, I'm sorry for all I put you through.
Swallow does not come out looking like a hero in this.
No. Kirk makes a couple mentions to the fact that, you know, he was shocked that John was making $24,000 on a side consulting deal for a cement project in Nevada. He said that, you know, Mark didn't do anything, even though, you know, for almost a full year, John was not seen in the office, which we don't know if that's true or not. But that was Kirk's impression of it. And Kirk being, you know, Swallow, there were two chief deputies in the office. One was Kirk Torgerson, the other was John Swallow. So you would think that Kirk would have some knowledge of that. So it's one other thing that probably needs to be noted about these text messages is we don't really know the full context of them. They bounce around a lot. They go from, like I said, April to May to June. You know, we don't have the full context of them. There may have been more there. And investigators, when they went in, ultimately in January of this year, investigators got a search warrant for Kirk's phone because they wanted to see the full context of these messages. Because they weren't sure that they were necessarily getting the whole story. So we may not be getting the whole story either. We don't have the actual messages that the investigators were able to pull off of Kirk's phone, assuming they were, but presumably they were able to do that. So, you know, maybe we're getting cherry-picked snippets that, you know, somebody pulled out to make themselves look good. Kirk, in the affidavit that supported the search warrant, Kirk was telling people that these text messages were his quote-unquote insurance, you know, about, you know, in this case. So it's entirely possible that we're only getting a small snippet of the story, but that small snippet, I think, tells a pretty interesting story.
Yeah,
in itself.
Absolutely. I mean, what does it mean in the context of the investigations? Anything?
In the context of the investigations, I don't think you saw anybody admit to anything criminal. You saw Mark Shurtleff admit to some lapses in judgment. He was defensive about how he had not actually made any money from any of these deals that were allegedly made, and
he's kind of bitter about about money. You know, that his salary does not equal his deputies.
He notes that he was getting paid less than any of the other top officials in the office. He notes he didn't make any money on the book, and in fact, I think at one point says his book publisher screwed him on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like hardcore evidence that we might see at trial, there may or may not be information in there. One thing that is kind of interesting is that Mark was pointed out that he kept giving bonuses to these top officials, despite questions in the office about their performance and their actual the amount of work that they were doing. So, you know, that could come up later on down the road. But, mostly it's a peek inside sort of the mindset of these two key characters, these two key players in this Swallow Shurtleff scandal.
Mm-hmm. Where is Kirk Torgerson now? And did he comment on the story yesterday?
Well, yes and no. Kirk has been put on administrative leave, pending a review by the new attorney general and whether they're going to keep him on or not. I understand that review may be coming to some conclusion. His attorney, Brett Tolman, initially didn't get back to us, but the day after the story ran and we put it in the online version of the paper, that's sltrib.com if you want to go see it. said that, you know, there's this, I don't know if it's humorous or not, but there's this anecdote that shows up in the search warrants that when investigators went in to take Kirk's cell phone from him so they could retrieve all of the text messages, he initially refused. He tried to hold it out of the reach of the investigator, and the investigators had to physically remove it from his hand. Tolman said that, you know, denied that happened. He said Kirk was just trying to get a couple personal messages from his family off of the phone so that he could keep them before they took the phone from him. So, but as to the essence and sort of the narrative of the text messages, no, they said that's, you know, exactly right. And partly that, I think, is because the text messages paint a picture of Kirk Torgerson as somebody who had sounded the alarm, I guess, as it were, about some of these people, and had suggested to Mark Shurtleff that the things he was doing were not appropriate, and as a result, I think that's probably why, you know, and if Kirk did call them insurance, that's probably what he was referring to as his insurance policy.
Senator Todd Weiler tweeted out yesterday, "If you're in the public eye and the target of a criminal investigation, maybe you should cancel that texting plan." Paul Raleigh, is that sort of the moral of this story?
Probably, yeah. I you know, we're in a modern communications world, and maybe people don't really realize the vulnerability when they do things like this, even in that position. One thing I wanted to mention that stood out to me in Robert's story, reading the text, was the one text where Shurtleff was defending himself against Torgerson's criticisms, and said something to the effect that, you know, I defended you when people were complaining that you weren't there, you know, that you were gone all the time. Mm. So it wasn't just Shurtleff and Swallow. To me, that indicated kind of an atmosphere in the office of entitlement among some of the top guys. They could, you know, come and go as they please. They could be as gone as long and do things on the side as much as they wanted. But that indicated to me that Torgerson didn't exactly have clean hands either. And in fact, I've heard, and I think other reporters have heard over the years, that there were a lot of complaints about Torgerson from the staff. And Shurtleff alluded to that in that one text, that he defended Kurt against criticisms that Kurt was never there either. So it seems to have been kind of an atmosphere under the Shurtleff administration for years, that there was entitlement among the top administration. They didn't really take their responsibility to the public that seriously. It was more of a country club type atmosphere among themselves and their donors. And I thought that one text kind of indicated that as well.
And you kind of compound that. I think it might have even been in the same text where Shurtleff tells Kirk, "I gave you bonus after bonus after bonus," yeah, "in leadership position after leadership position." And so, there were obviously complaints that Kirk wasn't necessarily the most had the greatest work ethic, but he was still getting these bonuses from the attorney general throughout.
And yet there's a sense of embarrassment on Torgerson's part that he's been sort of wrapped into this and is humiliated. Do you feel like people are still feeling that in the aftermath at the AG's office?
Kirk, especially in stories and in conversations we've had subsequent to the scandal, has felt like he has been sort of unfairly tarnished by the actions of Shurtleff and Swallow, that he was the guy who was trying to sound the alarm, that he was the one who, you know, didn't, he didn't take part in these trips to Newport Beach, and he didn't take part in riding in the Ferrari and the plane like these guys did. But as sort of one of the top officials in the office, he ended up getting some of this mud spattered on him, I guess, for lack of a better term. And now, you know, and now he is paying a price for it, and that he has been demoted. He's taken a pay cut. He's on administrative leave, and his job is in question. The future of his job is in question. So yeah, he's paid a price for this, and the question is, you know, did he have that much to do with it? His insistence throughout these text messages and in other interviews is that he didn't.
Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke is with us, also columnist Paul Raleigh and assistant managing editor Dave Noyce. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and joining me this hour, Paul Raleigh, Dave Noyce, and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, and we're talking about the week's top stories. You can join us, too. Send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us live, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And joining us now by phone, Tribune education reporter Lisa Shanker is with us. Lisa, good morning.
Morning.
And you reported this week on some fractures in the massive Jordan school district. Bring us up to date. What's happening with South Jordan?
Sure. South Jordan is waiting for a feasibility study to come back, looking into splitting off from the Jordan school district.
And why?
South Jordan is a very rapidly growing city, and some of the leaders there feel like the Jordan School District isn't keeping pace with their rapid growth. They feel like they need more new schools in their area, and they're not getting them, and they're getting frustrated.
West Jordan sort of shared that concern, and they contemplated splitting off, but this week they sort of changed direction, the city council deciding to hold off. What were the reasons?
Sure. West Jordan actually is not upset with the Jordan School District. They don't feel like they're having a problem with the district. I think their concern was more about what was going to happen if South Jordan left. They were worried, are we going to be left holding the bag? What is this going to mean for our students? What is it going to mean financially? And so they just wanted to make sure they knew their options, but they ultimately decided not to pursue that feasibility study.
So give us the background of Jordan School District. What cities are there? Because this splitting off conversation, I sort of have a sense of deja vu since it was tremendous population growth and this perception of financial inequity between different parts of the district that led to the creation of the canyon. So sort of give us the backstory on that.
Sure. Yeah, it's not surprising that you're feeling a little deja vu. I think there were somewhat similar issues going on when voters decided to split into a new district in 2007, and that district, of course, became the Canyon School District. There was an issue there of, at the time, East Side voters feeling like they weren't getting the resources, that the West Side was getting all the resources, and that they felt the district wasn't listening closely enough to them, and that those were some of the basic reasons behind that split in 2007. This time around, the other cities that would be left in the district, Bluffdale, I believe Harriman, Riverton, some unincorporated parts of Salt Lake County.
So if South Jordan leaves, though, what would it mean for the thousands of students left in the Jordan District and for the cities that are in the Jordan District?
I think that is one of the big questions that is making some of these other cities kind of nervous. And we'll see what the feasibility study brings back in South Jordan. But what it meant last time around when Canyon split was residents across Salt Lake County saw their taxes go up, regardless of whether they were in the Jordan District or not, or Canyons. Essentially, what happened is when Canyon split off from Jordan, there was a lack of enough property tax revenue going toward Jordan. And so to make up for that, all the districts in Salt Lake County ended up having to send some money to the Jordan School District, and a lot of the districts in Salt Lake County ended up raising their taxes to pay for that.
How much? What kind of tax hike?
You know, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's actually the tax increases that are going to be ending in 2016. But I think there's worry among some of these other cities that it could lead to that sort of a thing again.
Is all of this talk giving teachers and parents out in the South Valley the jitters? I mean, what's the reaction out there?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of people who are kind of feeling like, oh, no, not again. A lot of people who are worried about it. I've heard a lot of opponents speaking of the split or of the potential split. And so we'll see how much support there is out there. I mean, when the feasibility study comes back in August, at that point, the South Jordan City Council will decide whether or not to put the question on the November ballot. And then it'll be up to voters in South Jordan to decide whether to split.
So for now, the Jordan School District is going to stay whole for the next school year. After that, who knows?
Right. Yeah, it wouldn't take effect for next school year. It would take some time.
Okay. Lisa Schenker, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lisa Schenker covers education for the Salt Lake Tribune, and that's a story I suspect we'll hear more of. Dave Noyce.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what happens, because a lot is hinging on South Jordan and West Jordan sort of hedging its bets as to what South Jordan's going to do, too, waiting to see. You know, I don't really think that the Jordan District, and maybe a lot of the districts in the Valley, have recovered yet from that split that happened with Canyons. I know a lot of West Siders viewed that split as they were very much against it. They had they didn't have a say in it, even though it was their district also. And I think that they saw it as, you know, we build all your schools on the east side, now the west side's growing, mm-hmm. and you bolt when it's time to build our schools on our side. And that's how they saw it.
That old east side, west side
thing. The east-west divide, which we did a bit special section on about a decade ago, that came up in that, as a matter of fact. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Residents care a lot about schools. That's and education. That's always number one on the list. And the interesting thing is, in our government, city politics has very little to do with how schools are run. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see a city wanting to become Murray, essentially, and have their own school district.
Paul, did you have something to add? Oh, sorry.
I was just Robert? Saying, and Paul knows this very well, too. I mean, these things become very political. And, you know, the legislature during the Canyons Jordan district was intimately involved in. And I think, you know, if we're going to see another split or another attempt at a split, I think that's going to play out up at the Capitol. I mean, that's how it went down last time in many ways.
Paul?
Well, I was going to say that one of the things that might be a little troubling about this is if South Jordan is driving this bus and other cities are looking toward South Jordan. South Jordan, there are indications that South Jordan is dysfunctional. Their government, their city council, they've been having all sorts of fights with each other. They actually banned one of their city council members from meetings for a couple of meetings. They said that he had a conflict of interest because his uncle was one of the bidders on this project for Mulligans that they want to develop. You know, as others have pointed out, people can always, declare their conflicts and recuse themselves from votes without being banned from the entire meetings. And that's led Rich Cunningham, a legislator from South Jordan, to talk about proposing legislation basically outlawing city councils from banning one of their elected members from their meetings. Last year, I wrote about another city council member who's no longer there. He got defeated in his reelection bid, but he had written a commentary in the local paper in South Jordan, and they spent the entire meeting reprimanding him and censoring him and demanding, like, sort of an Animal Farm kind of moment, you know, where they demanded that he, like, come, you know, repent and get on his knees and apologize and all this other stuff. And the mayor out there is, you know, he's shown that he's a very, very Tea Party kind of guy, doesn't believe in government and everything else, and he's always fighting, you know, on emails and stuff with the other city council members. So, I mean, there's some problems out there in their government, and for them to be driving this bus. I was told by some members of the Georgia School Board that when the bond issue was coming up, and there were members of the South Georgia City Council who were leading the fight against that and very you know, critical of that. The Sunday before the bond issue was going to be voted on, all the wards out there in that area, you know, their cars, their windshields had flyers on them. When everybody got out of church, everybody had a flyer on their windshield talking about all the evils and everything of the Jordan School District and their bond and everything else. Mm-hmm. And they suspect that it was, you know, people like in the South Jordan City Council that were. There seems to be some, in fact, South Jordan, I've decided something I want to keep my eye on for a while because it's getting to be a rather colorful, you know, little government out there.
Mm-hmm. And just by a quick prediction, if I can make a prediction, I think this isn't the last one we'll see. I think there's this sort of overwhelming trend toward smaller school districts. Mm-hmm. They think they're more responsive. They think they think the parents have more say in them. They also tend to have more administrative costs. So, you know, there's a give and take. But I think this isn't the last one we'll see, I don't think. Mm.
So, story Lisa will certainly continue to cover. I want to move on to daylight saving time. Daylight saving time. Utah lawmakers want to know how people feel about the time change, spring forward and fall back. And Dave, I guess they've held a series of town hall meetings. One was yesterday.
Yes. I think this came from Rhonda Menlove's.
Yeah,
bill, right. Legislation.
It got a little bit of its genesis, I guess, was in the legislature. Yeah, it all blurs together.
House Bill 197.
I couldn't remember if it was this year or last year.
It passed this session,
but
it's not the
first time. It could have been in 1998, for all I know. It all is a blur. But yeah, I mean, there was this push for it, and instead of doing anything definitive on it, they decided, well, let's go out and have some public scoping meetings and find out if this is something that we still want. I mean, you know, obviously the history of it is it's sort of the agrarian sort of model. You know, you don't want to be sending kids to school in the dark. There's the arguments against it are things like, well, okay, well, do we really want to be taking our kids to soccer games and having it pitch black, right? Do you have to put up lights in fields or, you know, so you can do this? So there are, and it's amazing to me from what I've seen so far and what I heard during the session, how passionately people feel about this issue. You know, and so they're going to move down that road this year. And I think, I don't remember if they're expecting to have a recommendation for the upcoming legislative session, but I think they'll probably have a pretty good idea and a pretty solid discussion by then.
Well, that online poll, which of course is not scientific, has got tens of thousands of comments and votes. So obviously they found an issue that people care passionately about. Its relative importance may
so
not
far.
Be so much. Yeah. So,
20,000
but it's
comments, which yeah. is kind of crazy.
And it, you know, it sort of split along generational lines. Also, it was at least that's how it's falling right now. Older residents, older Utahns, kind of against it. Younger Utahns younger parents, I say, with young children, sort of against them, want their kids going to school in the dark. But then there's this big mass in the middle that feels quite a bit differently. And some people were raising warning voices about if the state switched to just Mountain Standard Time year round, it could hurt economic development and hurt business. So, you know, there are probably real ramifications for this, although it may be hard to envision how that would happen.
It is always interesting when you put in a phone call to Arizona and you have no idea what time it is. But, you know, but they did this. This is the model that we're looking at, and the Earth is still rotating on its axis. So, we'll, you know, and the sun still comes up. It just depends on what time it comes up, I guess.
Right. I'm actually looking at the latest update on the data. So they asked three questions. Should Utah retain daylight savings? 14%. Should it align with Arizona, 68%. That means Mountain Standard Time would be Mountain Standard Time all year long. Or number three, should Utah create a new time zone, a new daylight saving time,
a Utah time zone,
which would mean a permanent spring forward? And 17% are in favor of that. That's out of 23,000 people.
This is
who
one
responded.
Of those stick it in the Fed's eyes, right? Poke a finger at the Fed's.
Permanent Utah time zone would be 1950 or something.
Right.
We had a caller, Roy from Elsinore. He thinks we need to eliminate daylight saving time. So if you want to chime in on the debate, feel free to call us 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255.
Let's just eliminate time and then it won't be late for things.
That's right.
I'm in favor of that. We need to take another break, but we will be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. And if you want to join us, send your tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com. Or again, give us a ring. 801-355-TALK is the number. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and in studio with me, Dave Noyce. He's the assistant managing editor, Robert Gerke, government reporter, and Paul Raleigh, columnist. And you are welcome to join us as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Put your comments at sltrib.com or send us a tweet on Twitter at the hashtag TribTalk. Time for our underplayed story of the week, the story that you think could live on well beyond this week. And Paul Raleigh, what you got?
Well, my underplayed story of the week is what's been going on in the Davis County Republican Party. In fact, last night there was a meeting. I haven't found out what happened, but I will last night. But the previous executive committee meeting of Davis County Republican Party had they'd voted to let the chairman of the party pick his own. I'm going to bring the Animal Farm reference again. his own little kangaroo court committee to do an investigation of the secretary of the party. To come back with recommendations whether she should be removed as party secretary. This all goes back to the fact that she signed the Count My Vote petition, which, according to certain members of the executive committee, actually I think the majority of the executive committee, is a mortal sin in the Republican Party, and she needs to be ousted. She's not one of them in the first place. They tried to prevent her from running for secretary last year. She had moved from Salt Lake County to Davis County in March last year, and then in May she wanted to run for secretary. She'd always been a registered Republican, which is a requirement to run for any office.
So it's a residency issue with her?
Well, that's where they tried to make it, but so she filed to run for secretary. She filed 10 days before the convention. And then at 6:30 the night before the convention, she was called by the then chairman, Chris Coleman, who's an Eagle Forum person. She was told that she would not be able to run because the next morning at the convention, they had 10 days to tell her this because she was not registered in Davis County. She was registered in Salt Lake County.
So really an 11th hour kind of.
Right. But this is a fight that's going on in the party, because then what happened, and this is I wrote about the disconnect again between the the people who are running the party and actually the elected officials and the Davis County elected officials and the general populace and the general Republican populace, is when they told her that, and that was not in the bylaws. There was nothing in there that said you had to be registered within the county. It said you had to be a county resident and a registered Republican. But she had friends in the party who then called up the county clerk, and he met her down at the clerk's office at 10 o'clock Friday night, the night before the convention, and registered her in Davis County. So they didn't have an argument the next day. But it was clearly they were trying to prevent her from becoming the secretary because she wasn't one of them. She wasn't one of the purists, I guess, in their minds. And that's going to this fight's going to continue. And I think that that's probably the underplayed story of the week so far, and I think it's going to continue to be. The other thing I was going to say is the irony of all this is it turns out the chairman of the Republican Party in Davis County was not a registered Republican.
Right.
through a technical glitch, you know, he ended up being an unaffiliated voter. So he, under their own bylaws, he has been the illegitimate chairman of the Republican Party for the past year.
Oh, that's going to keep you very busy. Davis County party politics. Dave Noyce, what's your pick for the underplayed story?
Underplayed, probably. Underreported, probably not. That was the latest essay that came out from the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. They've been releasing a string of these essays on their website under a heading of Gospel Topics. And this forum has been used to try to allow, the LDS Church to explain some of the more problematic points in its history and in its doctrine. The latest essay is probably a bit obscure to people who are not within the LDS Church, although it has
to do with Scripture.
Yeah, it's been a thorn for Mormon scholars and members for decades, actually, and that is this a book of Scripture called the Book of Abraham, which Joseph Smith, the Mormon Church founder, said he translated from papyrus and mummies and things like that that the church obtained, that his family obtained, in the mid-1830s, I think 1835 or something like that. And he began translating these papyrus. Never gave much great detail about how he translated them. And reported that they were, lo and behold, the writings and about the biblical patriarch Abraham. Within this book of Scripture, which is not all that long, actually, contains a lot of key points of Mormon theology, from premortal existence, sort of a unique teaching, and events that took place in the Garden of Eden, and things like that, and priesthood. All those things are sort of in there. The problem has been...
For the church to say that it wasn't a literal translation of the papyri, but instead inspired the Scripture is kind of big.
Well, they said it could be a literal translation. The problem is that they only have fragments and facsimiles left. A lot of these documents were destroyed, apparently, in the Great Chicago Fire. And so they have these fragments and pieces, and they've come to find out that the pieces don't match what's left, what Joseph Smith purported to translate. So the LDS Church says, well, it's possible that those documents were destroyed, and that there is a literal Book of Abraham that Joseph Smith literally translated. But the other avenue that they opened was that perhaps these papyri were just a vehicle, a catalyst for Joseph Smith to gain revelation about the writings that were in the Book of Abraham.
And Robert, you've got 30 seconds for your pick.
I had two. One of my big underreported stories is that Paul Raleigh has a Cardinals mug, and Dave Noyce, our Cubs fan, hasn't slapped it out of his hand.
Yeah, I really am tempted to.
I would say a World Series Cardinals.
1908 wasn't that long ago.
I would probably, I guess the other one that I would say is that, you know, Jason Chaffetz came out this week and said he thinks Mitt Romney's going to run for president, which isn't an underreported story, but I think the real story is that Jason Chaffetz appears to be off his medication because Mitt Romney has said over and over and over that he's not going to run for president again, and unless Jason knows something we don't, which is entirely possible, I think that's not going to happen.
Got to leave it there. Robert Gerke, Dave Noyce, Paul Raleigh of the Tribune, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up today's program with the conversation with Robert Kirby, and this week, Kirby on gay marriage.
It's okay with me if they get married. It doesn't, you know, detract from my own marriage, and if it helps commit two people together for life who love each other, I'm all for that, because relationships don't have a good track record already.
As with many of your columns, it's got some reaction and not always favorable.
There were a lot of people who are upset because I'm a go-to-church Mormon. And this was a position that ran contrary to the church and its position on Prop 8, which is that marriage should only be between a man and a woman. And I frankly figured if I was going to be nagged by a wife, why shouldn't everybody? And not just me, or not just heterosexuals. And so I wrote a column about it that generated a lot of feedback, most of it angry from people, obviously, who were against gay marriage. But in the column I wrote, the only serious concern I have about gays getting married is that they'll register someplace pricey. The church is serious about the sanctity of marriage. I get that. But aren't more potentially dangerous marriages already being performed out there? For example, I hear in church all the time about marriage being ordained of God. But I also hear about how the glory of God is intelligence. Shouldn't it be against the law for two stupid people to get married? What's more harmful to society, two well-dressed men getting married and settling down, or two idiots tying the knot and cranking out any number of additional idiots?
Has your position changed at all over the years?
Well, I started out as not caring, you know, whether they could get married or not. It was none of my business. I'm not gay. I don't think my wife is gay, so it wasn't a problem that we needed to bother with. But the more I heard arguments countering gay marriage, the more I realized that there was really kind of an arrogant and self-righteous position to take on gay marriage. Because in the LDS community, you essentially have two choices if you're gay. You marry someone you're not physically attracted to, per se, which I suppose you could do. I mean, or your other choice is to be alone for the rest of your life. And that's not a choice that I would ever want to have to make or have forced on me. And so the more I've heard the rhetoric about gay marriage, the more I've decided that, yeah, why can't they get married? Let's let them get married.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can find him on the archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune, and many thanks to Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford at KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Until next time.